Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
We are extremely focused on stepping up, providing more support, more advanced weapons.
But Ukraine fears the supplies won't come fast enough as Russian forces gain ground in the east. Unpacking the challenges and potential consequences with retired U.S. Army General Ben Hodges. Then,
I've seen the river high a lot of times, but this is the highest I've ever seen it, though.
From record rains and flooding to dangerous heat, extreme weather grips countries around the world. But is the urgency to address climate change fading amid the world's other crises? NASA climatologist Gavin Schmidt joins me. And
if this framework becomes the actual piece of legislation, it's a step forward.
Will Congress finally pass meaningful gun reforms? Former Senator Russ Feingold on the chances for a deal and the explosive January 6th hearings. Plus,
anyone who succeeds after prison is succeeding in spite of prison, not because of it.
She went from ice skater to inmate. Now Corrections in Ink author Carrie Blakinger tells Hari Srinivasan how she's fighting to fix the broken prison system she endured.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Golodriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour. $1 billion with a B. That's how much more additional military aid the U.S. is expected to give Ukraine to fend off Russia. The announcement comes as Western intelligence officials say that the war has reached a pivotal point. Russia is clawing deeper into the Donbas, and Ukraine's president is pleading for more advanced weapons to halt their advance. A working group of nearly 50 countries is currently discussing this crisis in Brussels, and U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said that the Allies have recently provided Ukraine with more much-needed supplies like missiles and rocket systems.
Since the contact group first came together nearly 3 months ago, we've built tremendous momentum for donations and delivery of military assistance. And after this afternoon's discussions, we're not just going to maintain that momentum. We're going to move even faster and push even harder. We'll deepen our coordination and cooperation, and we'll bolster Ukraine's armed forces to help them repel Russian aggression now and in the future. So we'll continue working closely and intensively together with this contact group, and we'll keep on strengthening our support for Ukraine's self-defense, and we'll continue to stand up for the rules-based international order that protects us all.
But will those supplies reach Ukraine before it's too late? And does President Zelensky's persistent pleas for more weapons indicate a disconnect with the West over what Ukraine needs and when? Joining me now is former commander of American forces in Europe, General Ben Hodges. General, welcome to the program. First, let me get your assessment on the status of the war right now. Would you agree with many military analysts who suggest that this is the most pivotal and perhaps most dangerous time of the war?
No, it's not the most critical or pivotal, Bianca, but it is dangerous. Ukrainian soldiers are suffering under the constant pounding of Russian artillery and rockets. But, you know, we have got to be able to step back from the day-to-day tactical fight a little bit to understand the overall operational situation. The Russians are using everything they have, all of their advantages, and they're still trying to capture this one city, Severodonetsk. So I think if we keep that in perspective, and what I just heard from Secretary Austin, the clip you just played, You know, there, you can hear the sense of urgency in his voice and the seriousness with which he is trying to push capability to Ukraine. We are way behind, but it is absolutely not too late.
How did that happen, that the U.S. in particular with its assistance to Ukraine, because obviously we've provided the most assistance militarily, is so behind? We know that President Biden spoke with President Zelensky today about this additional $1 billion in military aid, and that consists of howitzers, ammunition, coastal defense systems, et cetera. But we in the media have been hearing directly from President Zelensky over the course of the past 2 weeks saying he needed this a while ago.
Yeah. Well, it's a fair question. And of course, there's two or three reasons why we are where we are. First of all, the administration had to make decisions along the way. And I think, candidly, well-intentioned, hardworking people in the White House, but we have been deterring ourselves for months. I mean, you can remember, and your viewers will remember, that about 3 months ago, we were arguing about whether or not to provide Stinger, that somehow if an American-made Stinger was used to shoot down a Russian helicopter, it would somehow provoke the Russians. And so we've had to stair-step our support over the past several months. That's one reason why we are so far behind. The second reason, and by the way, our allies will tend to follow us, and Secretary Austin, of course, the work he's been doing with the other defense ministers has helped create the opportunity for other nations to contribute. The second reason, though, that we are so far behind is that, again, all of the allies have decided we are not going to put boots on the ground in Ukraine. So that means all of these capabilities, they get to Poland or Slovakia or Romania, they still have to be picked up by Ukrainians and brought forward to where they're going to be employed in the fight. So the this is kind of tedious, but this is part of the explanation. The distribution network inside Ukraine, without our physical help, whether uniformed or maybe even commercial logistics companies, it takes a long time to get it there. And then there is a fact. It takes time to train soldiers. Ukrainians are the smartest in the world. I mean, I've never seen anybody adapt to new technology faster than them. It still takes weeks to train on some of these systems.
Right. And we know that they're currently burning through Soviet-era ammunition as they await for this new, more modern weaponry to come from the United States. I'm wondering how much, in your view, that this lack of urgency, as you sort of describe, along with the training and the logistics of it all, it has to do with how we've been getting intelligence from the Ukrainians. Because there is a school of thought that this open source intelligence, that relying on Twitter and what we're seeing in large part from the Ukrainians themselves over the past few weeks and months, was that this was sort of a David and Goliath battle where the Ukrainians were steamrolling over the Russians. But now all of a sudden we are seeing advances made by the Russians. They are changing course. They are fighting at a level where most had expected them to initially begin this battle. And we're seeing hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers either killed or wounded daily. How much of a lack of direct intelligence and knowledge on the ground do you attribute to this delay in getting them what they need now?
So let me challenge you just on one or two things. I would not say there's a lack of urgency on the part of the administration, but there is a lack of a strategy. That's why, you know, when Secretary Austin said we're going to help Ukraine win, that was music to my ears and the ears of many other people that care about this situation. But what I haven't seen is the follow through. Oh, okay, win means we're going to push everything to them, not because we know what they need, versus waiting on specific requests. Now, what the Russians are doing now, of course, this is medieval. This is the only thing they can do is artillery and rockets, wheel to wheel, just continuously firing and attriting Ukrainian defenses. They are no better today than they were 3 months ago when they tripped all over themselves when they tried to attack into Ukraine. So they have pulled all these units out and they have now focused everything they have, which is considerable, still trying to capture this one city of Severodonetsk. So I think that if we of course, it's pure hell if you're a Ukrainian soldier in that area right now. But if we can keep our eye at the operational level and keep pushing capabilities, this is going to change.
Yeah, we spend so much time focused on Severodonetsk, but there are other cities in the crossroads, in the crosshairs. There's Slovyansk, there's Kramatorsk. The Ukrainians still haven't managed to firmly get a grip of Kharkiv and control that, the second largest city in the country. And you're also hearing more concern about morale, not just initially what we've been always hearing on the Russian side, but now even on the Ukrainian side, going back to my earlier point, that they are experiencing severe troop loss, massive troop loss, yeah, whether through injuries and death. How concerned are you that at some point this is just going to be a matter of who, which side is exhausted first?
Well, you make an excellent point. And war, as we know, is a test of will as well as a test of logistics. And I think that the Russians are exhausted. I do not believe they have the capability to launch a second offensive. They're using everything they can now in a medieval approach of artillery pounding away, and they do make some minor gains in some places, they lose in some places. That's why it is so critical that we get to them the artillery and rockets that can destroy or disrupt what Russia has. That's the only thing that Russia has. If we get them the dozens of rocket launchers that we have to give them, and the long-range artillery and the ammunition for it, I think we're going to start seeing a difference. Most of what we've provided is not yet really in the fight yet. So I have more optimism about what's going to happen in the next few weeks. But it is going to be very difficult for Ukrainian defense forces for the next few weeks.
Are you concerned at all that the longer this war prolongs, and listen, this is an issue for both sides, even though Russia does manufacture their own weapons, there is this question of at what point are we going to see a stockpile depletion? Much of the assistance that have come from European countries, we're already seeing early indications that they may not be able to provide much more weaponry. Obviously, the U.S. is a different story. But even on the U.S. side, are you concerned at all that you know, we also have to have our own significant stockpile prepared for our own security? Is that concern on the horizon at all, in your opinion?
Yeah, it is. The Russians are able to produce artillery ammunition, but they can no longer produce precision weapons because of the sanctions. So they only have the ability to use artillery. I've read reports like you where they're pulling old tanks out of storage. These things are months away from being ready to actually employ in any meaningful way. They have a serious manpower problem. They don't appear to be willing to do any sort of a mobilization yet. That would be a real problem domestically for President Putin. The Ukrainians started late on the creation of their territorial defense force, but this situation is going to improve, I believe, in the coming weeks. So, yes, it is a test of will. It is a test of logistics. But I think that what we have got to do, we got to stop this talk about we need a ceasefire. That's the dream situation for the Russians is a ceasefire where it locks in all of their gains. And then other nations start hesitating on providing anything else because, okay, well, there's going to be a ceasefire. Russia cannot escalate with anything except a nuclear weapon. And I think this is very unlikely. And we have got to stop hamstringing or pulling our punches. Maybe that's a better metaphor.
Right. Listen, they've already militarized and weaponized war and oil, and they're now doing that with commodities and food. It's going to create a crisis around the world. But I'm glad you brought this issue up of ceasefire, because I want to get your thoughts on what we've heard once again from French President Emmanuel Macron a couple of weeks ago. It was that the West can't humiliate Russia, even though in Vladimir Putin, even though he's a grown man, he's been in power much longer than any other Western elected leader there. But today he said negotiations are inevitable. And I'm going to quote what he said, because at some point when we have helped as much as possible to resist, and I hope that Ukraine will have won, and above all for the fighting to have stopped, we will have to negotiate. This comes at a time when Vladimir Putin and many people in the Kremlin believe that they are winning and time is on their side. What do you make of these comments from Emmanuel Macron?
Extremely unhelpful and also not very well informed. Look, President Putin has already humiliated himself. His soldiers are murdering with precision weapons, precision missiles into apartment buildings, schools, and hospitals. His soldiers have looted, raped, and murder their way across eastern Ukraine. And then President Putin presented an award to the unit that did that. So I don't know what we could do that would humiliate him more in the eyes of the world than what he has done himself. I think I sort of understand the thinking behind what the French president has said, that we got to provide them some sort of an off-ramp. But certainly President Macron and his advisors heard what President Putin said the other day, that it's his job, it's fallen to him to rebuild the empire that Peter the Great had established. And you hear the Duma each day talking about they're going to unrecognize the independence of Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Ukraine. So let's be clear about who it is we're dealing with.
Yeah, Vladimir Putin doesn't look like a man who's in desperate need of an off-ramp at this point, at least in his opinion. General Hodges, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for the privilege, Bianca.
Well, Russia's war on Ukraine is worsening another global threat, and that is climate change. Soaring energy prices have created a gold rush for gas production, scientists say. Now, that's happening even as the devastating consequences of an overheated planet torment us. Today, nearly 100 million Americans could face severe storms. And after record rainfall, the swollen Yellowstone River swept away this house. Fortunately, there was no one inside, but there's also the intense heat. Spain is smashing records while France and the UK remain on high alert. And don't forget the blazing temperatures that scorched India and Pakistan earlier this year. So with all of that, why does it seem that the focus on climate change is waning? Here to discuss is NASA climate scientist Gavin Schmidt. Gavin, great to have you on again. You know, I was looking back at our last conversation last year, and unfortunately, I might as well just air that interview because not much has changed. We were talking about record heat waves, record rainfall, record drought, and here we are again doing the same thing in the midst of a war and coming out of a pandemic. How worried are you that climate change and all of these records that we're setting almost on a daily basis are put on the back burner right now?
So people are living the impacts of climate change right now. You know, I mean, you mentioned all the things that are going on in the U.S. this week and in Spain and in India in recent months. We're seeing these impacts, and it's becoming abundantly clear to people on the ground that climate change is real. It's here and it's having an impact. So I don't think that it is going to go onto the back burner. Some of the issues that have arisen because of the fighting in Europe in the Ukraine, the impacts on food, the impacts on prices. A lot of people are then saying, well, maybe these are opportunities as well to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, reduce our dependence on imported gas, and move towards more renewables. And I think that there is going to be those continued pressures. There are short-term things that people are wanting to do, but I think the long-term trend, the more volatility there is, the longer, the more people will be pushing towards more sustainable renewable sources.
But Gavin, that's long term. And that's, of course, something that President Biden campaigned on. And yet you never know what kind of crisis will fall into your hands. And here the same day you have President Biden, who was pushing for renewables and alternative sources of energy, is now sending letters demanding that oil companies produce more oil and expand capacity and really castigate them for not drilling more. And he's going to Saudi Arabia soon to do the same of OPEC. So how do you make sense of that? And how much of a setback would that be for addressing the crises we're facing today?
Well, the crises that we're facing today have been built up from a long-term increase in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for the most part. And we really need to be looking at the long term to try and get us off that. There are going to be pitfalls. There are going to be bumps in the road. We had reductions in emissions because of the restrictions associated with COVID. Those have gone away, and now we have these new crises. We anticipate that there will be ups and and downs in what happens. My personal preference, I mean, obviously I can't tell the president what to do, but my personal preference is that we keep our eyes on that longer term thing, because it the 1 year here and there, 1 month, what, like, those things don't really matter. It really matters what's happening in the long term. And in the long term, we need to get to net zero carbon dioxide within the next few decades if we're going to avoid the worst outcomes.
Yeah, and you told me that once we get to net zero emissions is when global warming will stop. And let's talk about what we're experiencing today. We just listed a few of the extremes that we're hitting and seeing in terms of records. Yellowstone is flooded in the Midwest. Chicago, stifling humidity. Meantime, it's fire season and a lack of humidity. How does this all happen? I mean, meteorologists call this sort of a ring of fire. Explain what that is.
I'm not sure what that means in this context, but what we're talking about is there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, so that when it rains, it's raining more intensely. The heat of the system is increasing, and so when we have a heat wave, the heat waves are more intense. When we have a drought, there's more evaporation, and so that's reducing water resources even more. You know, the Lake Mead, Lake Powell, the Colorado River are at record lows since they were filled, and we're only a few hundred feet away from losing the Colorado River entirely for this summer. And that's very, very concerning for all of the millions of people that rely on the water that comes through that system. So all of these things have ties to the overall climate change and the overall warming that we've seen because of the increases in greenhouse gases. So there are very direct ties between what we're doing in terms of emissions and what we're seeing in terms of impacts. But it's a long-term effect, right? What we're seeing now is the impact of emissions that have been happening for decades. And so we need to reduce those emissions if we want to stop these current situations getting even worse.
Do you see that same urgency that President Biden had going into this administration in office and that many leaders of Western, of European nations have had? Do you see that urgency as still something that's a priority for them, again, given everything else from the pandemic to the war in Ukraine to now inflation and economic woes that many countries are experiencing?
So the way the world works is that there are always these immediate issues that require that need your attention, and so, you know, politics I think was once described as, you know, being forced to watch a 500 channel universe, and somebody else was changing the channel every 30 seconds. That's very true, and so countries have to be responding to those changes. But what I've found in discussions at the administration level or internationally is that people more and more are seeing the climate issue as a backbone, as part of the solution to all of those different things. And so it hasn't gone away in the same way that it might have disappeared, you know, 10 or 15 years ago when there was another economic crisis. So the persistence of climate as an issue, I think, is much stronger this time around and now than it was a decade ago. And I think that indicates that people are still thinking about, the impacts on climate will be of any of the decisions that they're making in the short term. And I think that's a very positive development.
So the optimism you're expressing comes from the fact that let's not focus as much on what's happening right now, which hopefully is just a temporary situation, and instead focus on the investments made for years down the road. My question to you on that front is, we now have administrations both in the United States and in other European countries and Western nations where this is a priority for them, and that's where they are putting many of their resources. But as you know, in most of these countries, barring, you know, Russia and China, which we'll get to in a moment, administrations change and priorities change and investments change. Our previous administration here in the United States, obviously we got out of the Paris Climate Accord. Have you factored that into the optimism that you're expressing now? What could happen in the next election, both in the United States or in other major economies?
I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, there are winds of change. There's turbulence in political markets, and it's very similar to the whole distinction between weather and climate in the first place. You know, so we see a lot of weather changes. We see cold and warm spells just as part of the normal weather. But what we're really focused on is the climate, the long-term trends. And I think we need to be focused on the long-term investment trends, the long-term movements away from coal, away from internal combustion, towards electric vehicles, towards renewables, towards more livable cities, towards better climate justice. All of those things are long-term issues, and we can keep nudging them. We can keep nudging people at many, many different levels, not just at the federal or the international level, but at the city level, at the town level, at the school level, at the community level. We can be pushing all of those things along more than we have been.
And are you hopeful that China can be pushed as well?
So China has made statements where they're pledging to get to peak emissions by 2030. Whether that happens, it remains to be seen. But the pledges are there, and we can encourage them. I think, you know, the world, I mean, I can't personally, but the world can encourage them to live up to those pledges, just as the world is trying to encourage everybody else in the international arena to live up to their pledges. And if we manage to meet those pledges that came out of the COP26 effort and the renewal of the nationally determined contributions last year, then we're going to be in a much better place than we thought was possible even 5 years ago.
Yeah, pledges are one thing, actions quite another, and we are looking for action. But I appreciate the optimism there, Gavin. We need it. Gavin Schmidt, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, on issues like climate change, voting rights, and abortion, Congress seems stymied by party divisions. But is a bipartisan breakthrough on gun reform coming? The effort got a big boost after Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell indicated his support, and Democrats and Republicans have also united to probe the January 6th attack. So here to help us decode the inner workings of Capitol Hill is former Democratic Senator Russ Feingold. He's now the president of the American Constitution Society. Senator, great to have you on. So you have the perspective of sitting in the Senate, but now sort of a purview now from the outside looking in and getting a chance to look at this as objectively as possible now that you're not there in Congress. So let's talk about what we can expect to see tomorrow, the January 6th committee. The focus will be on the former president's pressure on his vice president, Mike Pence, who ultimately did his job by certifying the results of the 2020 election, facing enormous pressure, as we now know and hear more evidence of, and despite erroneous legal theories. What are you going to be focused on tomorrow, specifically from those who will be testifying? And that's going to include Judge Michael Luttig, who advised the former vice president, and Greg Jacob, who is Pence's top lawyer at the White House.
Thank you, Bianna. What we're going to focus on, and what we at the American Constitution Society are focused on, is that this is a fundamental, almost existential threat to our democracy, that these series of events occurred. And the Select Committee has done a tremendous job of sort of carefully laying these things out. What we're going to hear about tomorrow, as you said, is the fact that the President of the United States apparently broke two federal criminal statutes by pressuring the Vice President to not certify the election properly. And Liz Cheney, who's been incredibly heroic on this, has already issued a video where she lays this out. And these are just some of the offenses that the President clearly was involved in. From the very beginning, he tried to spread false and fraudulent information about the fact that the election, he claiming that the election was stolen. He tried to corruptly pressure the vice president, and he tried to pressure state and local officials to change voting counts. So on so many counts, they're going to go through carefully to show that this president clearly threatened our democracy, in my view, probably broke a whole lot of federal laws. And the bottom line is he can't be really allowed to be a candidate for president again, as much as he wants to.
So is that what these hearings are about? I mean, I guess they could be about more than one thing, but is it to make sure that President Trump, former President Trump, can't hold the office again? Or is it to prevent something like January 6th or the buildup to it from ever happening again?
Well, it's clearly most importantly about making sure that something like this never happens again. It's never happened before. It happens to be the case, though, that there is a clear and present threat that this former president could try to do the same thing. He has demonstrated time and again his willingness to do almost anything. So it's about the larger threat, but the most immediate aspect of that larger threat is Donald Trump himself, who I'm pretty sure violated just about every federal statute you can think of in trying to evade the results of the election. So I give the Select Committee tremendous credit. They've used almost not only Republican voices, they have used Trump voices, people that work for Donald Trump, to prove that what he was doing was entirely inappropriate and he knew it.
Right. And those who we heard from, and some of the most damning evidence and testimony that we heard were from people who were actually supporting him, either legally or professionally, during his previous impeachment. So that was really telling. Also telling was Liz Cheney teasing testimony that we're going to hear tomorrow from former White House lawyer Eric Hirschman, who recounted his phone call with attorney John Eastman, who had been one of the staunchest supporters for the president to continue with this fight, using debunked legal theory that the vice president did not have to certify the votes. Let's play this sound and remind you in our audience that this all took place after January 6th.
He started to ask me about something dealing with Georgia and preserving something potentially for appeal. And I said to him, "Are you out of your effing mind?" Right? I said, I only want to hear two words coming out of your mouth for now on. Orderly transition. Eventually he said, "Orderly transition." I said, "Good, John. Now I'm going to give you the best free legal advice you're ever getting in your life. Get a great effing criminal defense lawyer. You're going to need it."
I mean, that's just like something out of a movie. First of all, just his recount and hearing him say that. But that also seems to be an indication, you know, from one lawyer to another, that he needs to get a criminal defense attorney. Is that, in your view, Liz Cheney suggesting that the Justice Department has grounds to step in too?
Well, I think Liz Cheney is just doing her job, which is laying this out after 1,000 interviews. But it's clearly the case that the Justice Department has to look at this series of attempts to subvert our Constitution and the rule of law, and they have to look in terms of the possibility of indictments and to potentially seek convictions. But even if that doesn't happen, laying this out, showing that even Trump supporters like this lawyer you just described realized that he had really jumped the shark, that he had gone to the point where he was willing to say the craziest things even to people who used to support him, is a sign that what you have is a loose cannon in our democracy. And somehow we have to prevent this loose cannon from shooting again.
It's interesting and perhaps reassuring to hear of names and people that most Americans had never heard of really standing up to the former president and allowing the democratic process to go through as it is meant to. That having been said, what is your take on the fact that they didn't speak out earlier, that it required, you know, being addressed and asked to come speak before a committee to get this on the record?
Well, that's a difficult question, and each person has to answer for themselves. But, you know, I'm old enough to remember all of this under Watergate. These were Nixon loyalists, John Dean and many other people who finally realized that it was appropriate for them to testify and to give the truth to protect our democracy. I mean, Liz Cheney is a great example. She wasn't just a Republican. She was a conservative Republican and a strong supporter of the president. But they all realized at some point that this had gone too far, that you couldn't justify it, you couldn't balance it. And they're doing what's right for our country. And we should be praising them at this time for that.
But, Senator, is that wishful thinking? I mean, we all know that the majority of Republicans then all aligned with Democrats after Watergate in those hearings, ultimately leading to the resignation of President Nixon. That wasn't the case in two impeachments prior, and it doesn't seem to be the case now for the majority of Republicans, Liz Cheney notwithstanding, and Adam Kinzinger. The majority of Republicans are either focusing away from these hearings or focusing on the economy. And I'm just curious, given your history and the fact that there was another economic malaise, the 2008 financial crisis, that ultimately led you losing your job and the Tea Party wave growing in this country, are you worried that everything that we're talking about right now will sort of be swept under the rug and the focus again will shift to what looks like we're entering another harsh economic challenge for the country?
Well, I think you're right. It would be a mistake to think this is going to be the only thing on voters' minds in the fall. This year, it will be on their minds, but many other things, inflation, obviously gas prices, and all the other problems will be there. But I think this has a long-term effect, particularly with regard to the 2024 election. When you look in the face of the possibility of somebody like Trump being president again, that raises different issues than the midterm election. And I think that these select committee hearings are absolutely going to make sure that the American people never make the mistake of making this guy president again.
So I spent the majority of this time focusing on the polarization in the country right now. Let's talk about some bipartisan legislation that appears to be shaping up in the framework of gun reform. We see Mitch McConnell endorse it. Again, this is a framework. It's not a done deal, but you do have 10 GOP senators working with Democrats, and it does seem like there is momentum to get real change here for the first time in decades. Are you satisfied with the bill and this framework right now, and are you surprised that they were actually able to come together on at least this issue?
Well, Bianca, I have to be honest with you, it's just heartbreaking that it takes Buffalo and Uvalde to get this very mild piece of legislation to be potentially in a position where a bipartisan bill can pass. It appears to be worth passing. It moves in the right direction in terms of getting the records of juveniles who may have been involved in very serious matters. It may help with domestic violence aspects. It may encourage red flag laws at the local level. But here's the problem. Even if this is passed, do any of us really believe this is going to stop these mass shootings? Does anyone really believe this is going to be enough? And so when that happens, we're going to have to do more. We're going to have to make sure that the gun companies don't have immunity from liability, which they have, in order to really get at the economics of this thing. So I think it's good that the dam is breaking, that the NRA is not able to prevent anything from happening. But the trouble is, we are still the only country in the world that has a problem like this, and this isn't going to solve it. But I do want to see it passed, and I do want to see more done.
Senator Russ Feingold, thank you so much. At least we'll end on some bit of hopefulness there and seeing parties be able to work together on at least an issue that's this important for our children and for the country. Thank you. One other issue plaguing the U.S. is its prison system, which, according to our next guest, is broken. Incarcerated for drug possession in college, Carrie Blakinger is now an award-winning criminal justice reporter. Her new memoir, Corrections in Ink, details how she went from competitive figure skater to prisoner to journalist. And she joined Hari Srinivasan to discuss her experience and her reporting.
Bianca, thanks. Carrie Blakinger, thanks so much for joining us. For people who aren't familiar with who you are today and how you got here, this book is Corrections in Ink is a fascinating read. And it starts out in a way where lots of books talk about a teenage girl who's into ice skating, whose parents are driving her back and forth to rinks. And then you get to Cornell, one of the best schools in the country. And I want to know what happened, what changed in your life?
Well, I think things went a little off the rails before I got to Cornell, after my skating career fell apart. I skated pairs, which is where the guy throws you around and it looks all dangerous. And when my pair partner decided to branch out and find another partner, I just kind of fell apart. Skating has sort of been my whole life to that point, and I fell apart without it and spent the next 9 years off and on doing drugs. I was doing sex work. I was homeless at times. But throughout that, I still prioritized doing well in college, which I know sounds so absurd, but to me, that was sort of the one measuring stick that, you know, that I was not too far gone. Like, if I could still pull together decent grades, I could tell myself it would be okay in the end. So I was doing heroin while I was in school at Rutgers, and then eventually transferred to Cornell because I was still getting decent grades and I guess things looked okay on paper. But then by the time I got to Cornell, I was already pretty heavily into drugs and continued to use drugs while I was there.
When you were writing the book, was there a moment that you figured out why drugs entered your life?
I think that during the years that I was skating, people that knew me probably would have been pretty aware that I was intense and obsessive and depressed. I was struggling with eating disorders. And when my skating career fell apart, that seemed like I was losing my whole social circle, my whole present, you know, my future. Like, that was the future I envisioned for myself. And I kind of liken it to getting divorced and fired from your job and also every job forever. And at 17, I was not particularly stable and not well equipped to handle that. And I was already on a self-destructive path. So I don't think, looking back, that it was particularly shocking that I took it to that sort of a dark place.
There's a line that says, on the one hand, I was staying sober and had even started working a summer job at a genetics lab. On the other, I was working in a toxic world of shady New Jersey strip clubs and selling eight balls of coke into the wee hours of the morning. How did you just physically balance this, much less kind of create the separation in your brain where, well, you thought this was still possible?
I mean, 37-year-old me looks back and has some of those same questions in terms of how I managed all that. But, you know, I mean, I think, like I said, I think that part of it for me was, on the one hand, I was really depressed and, you know, self-destructive. And, you know, I let drugs fill the hole in my life where skating had been. And so on the one hand, I was working towards self-destruction. But on the other hand, I was trying to, you know, do well enough in school that I could tell myself that that I wasn't completely a lost cause. I think I'd also been brought up to value academics so much that they seemed tantamount to, like, moral good. And I think this was also part of why I was so interested in making sure that I could maintain this, you know, dual life that seems so wild in retrospect, but, you know, I took almost for granted as my normal at the time.
It's clear in the book that you're smart in the sense that, you know, schoolwork was pretty relatively easy for you. You don't write about anything being a structural stumbling block. And even when I read the parts about you dealing drugs, I mean, there's a level of entrepreneurism, there's some calculation, there's risk assessment, critical thinking, not in the way that we think about it, but a lot of things required by a smart person not to, you know, get caught. And yet when you do get caught, it's, you know, incredibly just a tragic sort of scene. You have a Tupperware full of heroin that you're caught with.
Yeah, although I have to say, in terms of why I didn't get caught sooner, it's not just about being, you know, smart or savvy about your drug use. I mean, race has a lot to do with this. I can think of a lot of interactions that I had with police over the years that I think would have gone differently if I were black or brown. And, you know, I think that that has a lot to do with it. There's no amount of being smart that will really prevent you from getting caught forever. You know, drug use is, you know, it's legally risky. And eventually your luck runs out.
What were the charges, I guess, and how much time did you serve?
I was charged with drug possession, and I ended up serving 21 months on a 2.5-year sentence. And, you know, there's a few factors that went into that sentence, but one of the things that I think about a lot, aside from, you know, the racial privilege that I mentioned before, which I think sort of always has a role in criminal justice outcomes, But another thing that had a big role was the dumb luck of timing, because I was arrested in 2010, and that was right after the Rockefeller laws had been progressively repealed over a number of years. Some of the big parts of them were repealed in 2004 and 2009, and those laws had been some of the most draconian three strikes type laws in the country at the point at which they were enacted. And had I been sentenced under those laws, I would have gotten 15 to life, and I would still be in prison and not even eligible for parole yet. But by the time I got sentenced, those laws had been repealed, and I was able to get a 2.5-year sentence.
When you get into prison, what was the thing that kind of shocked you?
Oh, wow. You know, jail and prison is just such a different world. It's sort of its own kingdom in a lot of ways, to an extent that I think a lot of people don't understand. And I think one of the things that really illustrates this was actually not from my first days in jail, but months later when I got sentenced and I went to prison. And my first morning in prison, we were a bunch of us newbies were waiting to be transferred to another facility. And as we were waiting for the draft bus that would, you know, the bus that would take us to the other facility, I remember overhearing two guards talking about this woman who was in solitary, and she had, she'd taken a dump on a tray and pushed it back out the slot at the guards. I don't know why. I don't know if she was being vindictive, if she was mentally ill, if she had just been in there long enough that she was breaking. Like, I have no idea what prompted it. But I was listening to the guards talk about it, and one of them was wondering, they had decided to turn off the water in her cell in response to that act. And one of them was wondering what she was going to drink. And the other one said, well, she can just drink out of the toilet. If it's good enough for my dog, it's good enough for her. And that was a moment at which I sort of, it really drove home the idea that prison is really its own kingdom. There are effectively no rules. Like, sure, there are rules, but in the moment, if the staff want to do something, there's no oversight in that moment to prevent that from occurring. And that's one of the things that really stuck with me.
You had a sentence in there that struck me, and it said, solitary is not so much being alone as it is being buried alive. Explain that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when they hear solitary confinement, they think that solitary is just like spending time alone. And they'll say, oh, I like spending time alone. It would be like a break from all the stress of jail and prison. It wouldn't be that bad. And I might have thought that before I actually went in. But as soon as I first walked in that cell and they slammed the door behind me, I realized how incredibly wrong I was about that. It's, you know, a room the size of your bathroom or maybe a large elevator, and it was sort of neon white, and there's no clock and nothing to do and no one to talk to. And there was like a little window slit over the bunk, but you'd get yelled at if you stood on it to talk to anyone. And, you know, that's bad enough. But then when you add to it that this isn't voluntary, I think that people might think, oh, I can hang out in my bathroom for a while or whatever, and it's not great, but I'll survive. But the fact that you have no control over it, I think definitely adds another dimension. And in the end, I think solitary takes away sort of two of the core things about being human and how we define ourselves. You know, one of the ways we define ourselves as people is in relation to others, in our ability to interact with them, you know, self versus other. Like, this is part of how we define us. And then part of it is also just the ability to have agency, to make decisions, to take the steps and actions that define us. And solitary really takes away both of those.
It struck me how easily accessible drugs were through so many different facilities that you were incarcerated in. And I think most people would have a tough time understanding, wait a minute, she's describing this as commonplace. How is it so accessible?
Yeah, I think a lot of people assume that if you put someone in jail or prison, at the very least, they will be forced to dry out. You know, they'll be forced to stay sober for a little bit. They won't have access to drugs. But that is typically not true. You know, when I was in prison, I could get heroin delivered to my bedside if I wanted. And frankly, the places where I was incarcerated are not as drug-soaked as some of the prisons I write about now as a reporter.
And do you think that is there an incentive for the jail, the prison, to let that continue?
Well, I think it's difficult to stop because some of the sources are the staff. I mean, that's in a lot of systems, that's one of the big sources of how all kinds of contraband gets in. And, you know, if your staff are going to participate in that, that's really hard to route out.
In your work now as an investigative reporter at the Marshall Project, you've been focusing a lot on stories out of Texas. You wrote recently about the death of two prisoners from a fire, and we just don't think that that's possible inside a prison. This is an area where people are watched. We have safeguards for this. What went wrong?
Well, for one, I mean, many Texas prisons do not have working fire alarms in the housing areas. And the state fire marshal has flagged them on this for more than a decade. And, you know, they are several million short of what they would need to be able to make functional fire alarms. I think it was 55 million is what they said they expected it would take to put functional fire alarms in every facility. But, you know, this is also about sort of broader problems in terms of staffing and the way that prisoners are treated. In this instance, one of those fires, one at the Gibb Lewis unit, was started by a man who was trying to get higher ups to respond to an issue. And this is a thing that happens sometimes in Texas prisons, where people will start a fire if the officer on their unit is not responding to their needs. And the idea is that the fire will force someone from higher up to come respond to them. You know, maybe it's because they're not getting showers for days, or they're not getting fed, or, you know, sometimes it's other very basic needs. And the idea is that in starting a fire, they hope that a major or somebody will come down and ask what the problem is. But in this case, you know, nobody pulled the guy out of his cell. And he ended up being left in there while it was burning for, by several accounts, roughly half an hour. And he ended up dying of smoke inhalation. And, you know, as someone who's been covering Texas prisons, I wasn't particularly surprised by this outcome because I'd written about this problem before, about the lack of fire alarms, about, you know, understaffing, about the fact that prisoners were starting fires in their cells to protest conditions, or, you know, because they were acting out on mental health issues. That's a situation that I think would be shocking to the average person who doesn't know what really goes on in prisons. But as someone who's been covering it for some time, it seemed foreseeable.
What has the pandemic done to how we think of the incarcerated? What kinds of things changed for people behind bars?
I mean, I think predictably the pandemic was stark. It was bad in prisons. Prisons are essentially a petri dish for disease because they are communal living environments. And the best, the best thing that a lot of prisons could think of was to lock everybody down, confine them to bunks, or, you know, keep them in solitary, which is not a great solution. So, I mean, in that sense, it was dark, but it also was one of the first times that I can remember seeing so many people care about the deteriorating conditions behind bars. Because for once, people realized that this could affect them. Like, if these prisons just became sort of petri dishes for disease that would then come back out into the surrounding communities, it would affect everyone. And I saw there was a, you know, time period at the beginning of the pandemic where prisons and prison conditions actually got more coverage than I'd seen for quite a while. I'm not sure it made any difference. There were still, conditions were still bad. There were still a lot of lawsuits. Food got pretty inedible looking in some prisons. There was a lot of fires and, you know, just really appalling conditions. Although one of the other interesting side effects was that it became easier to document some of that, because in some facilities, prisoners were more able to hang on to contraband phones when there were fewer cell searches. So as bad as conditions got, it was not only a time where for some point, people seem to care a little more, but also it was easier to document.
So look, you're a fantastic journalist today and covering things that you feel are important to you. And I wonder if it's because of the experiences that you've had in your life and in the prison system, or in spite of it.
Well, I think that anyone who succeeds after prison is succeeding in spite of prison, not because of it. But I think that in terms of my ability to cover prisons, yeah, that inside knowledge has given me a different starting place than a lot of reporters. So I approach some of these stories in a different way. And I think that some of the people that I cover see that.
The book is called Corrections in Ink, investigative reporter for the Marshall Project, Carrie Blakinger. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Really important journalism, and what an incredible story. And finally tonight, sky watchers were treated to a strawberry supermoon that sweetened the sky last night. Supermoons are the brightest and biggest full moons of the year. Now, this happens when the moon reaches its closest approach to the Earth. Here you can see the moon rising behind an ancient temple on the coast of Greece. But you may be wondering why it's named after a pink berry when it doesn't have a strawberry hue. Well, the celestial body is in fact named after the beginning of the strawberry picking season in the Northern Hemisphere. See, we learn something new every day. Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcasts, and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.